It has been a while since I've done a podcast. I took a bit of a break, a very deliberate break, because I felt like it had kind of served its purpose after that first couple years. And the purpose really was to help me get more comfortable putting myself out there and speaking to a camera. And sure enough, you know, if you practice something and you face your fear, all of a sudden it doesn't become quite as big of a deal. And that's kind of where I'm at now. In fact, now, for the last year or so, I've been putting videos up once in a while on our main Essential Craftsman channel that I'm narrating and I show up in, and I would have never done that just a few years ago. I share all this because I'm going to get the podcast going again, although I think I'm going to focus it a little bit more on career and jobs and the transition that a lot of people exactly like myself and maybe you have to make from working to maybe starting or owning a business or maybe taking risks on a real estate deal or some type of speculative venture. These are the things that I have to think about over the last several years. And to this day, these are the decisions that stress me out the most. These are the conversations happening in my head. And so I'm kind of interested in having them a little bit more out loud and having interviews and conversations with people who can talk about things relevant to that. I hope that makes sense. Some portion of this will be the same types of guests, people deep in their career talking about how they got to where they are and the decisions and the forks that were in the road that they had, that they came to, that where they had to make choices. And that's what we've got today. I'm talking to Don Rees, who's the founder of RealCraft. And I put a video on our YouTube channel not too long ago that gives context to this, but I'll give you a little introduction here. Don started like a lot of us, where he actually went to school, got a degree, and then kind of came out still uncertain what he wanted to do. Kind of through coincidence, he got a job in construction as a carpenter. He took to carpentry like a duck to water and eventually started his own company building custom homes. He did that until he came to a fork in the road, whether to continue building custom homes or build custom doors. He had been making doors for his homes that he was building for his clients because he couldn't find the types of doors that he wanted and that his clients wanted him to put in, so he just made them. And the phone just kept ringing and ringing and ringing of other people who wanted those doors. So he made the decision to focus on that, and that has just developed into a really impressive organization, RealCraft, up in Gig Harbor, Washington, making high-end custom doors, carriage doors, pocket doors, barn doors, round-top doors, a bunch of other types of doors. You'll have to check out their Instagram to see what I'm talking about. So long story short, we're talking to Don. I hope you enjoy it. With no further ado, this is Don Rees from RealCraft.
I did college. I did a degree. And I had a degree in business, did engineering, did some of those kind of studies. And then when I got out of college, I went hitchhiking. And when I came back from hitchhiking, I was working, I ended up working in a bank, and I lasted about a week and a half, and it was like, I can't do this. And interestingly, I had two roommates at the time, and that were ex-convicts.
Wow.
So, and that started when I was in college doing kind of social work or a business, you know, about rehabilitation and things like that. So I ended up with two ex-convicts for roommates. And I quit the bank, working at the bank, and I came home. And the one roommate, who basically was an active bank robber at the time. So the irony of it was quite, I didn't know that at the time, but he was a carpenter. And so I think when he would rob banks in San Diego and then go to Seattle and be a carpenter for a while, and then rob banks in Seattle, and then go to San Diego. He had blonde hair. He was kind of had that beach look. But anyway, he said, well, why don't you be a carpenter? And I'm sitting on the couch, and I'm like, I don't know anything about carpentry. I don't know anything. Well, he was in the other room, sold me off as a journeyman. So we ended up getting an interview that very night, and by 7 o'clock the next morning, I was a journeyman working for this outfit. And I know he gave me a list of tools and tool bag, and so I had to go by the lumber yard when they opened and buy a tool bag and a hammer, tape measure, and drag them, take the tags off, put them in the parking lot, drag them around so they're dirty. And basically that's how I started in construction. So, but on day one, here's this college kid, right? But from day one, it's like, man, I just fell in love with the craft. I just, it was like I found my place at home. And I would come home in the evening or to this apartment where I lived, and I would sit him down and say, okay, what is this and what is that? And figuring it all out. And I remember the first day I had to finish framing a house where the lead carpenter had gotten in a motorcycle accident. And the foreman would point up and say, I need you to box in that soffit. And I would get, I remember getting behind his elbow because I had no idea what a soffit was. And it was like, soffit, okay, wow. I'm going to ask some questions. And then I had to frame the stairs, and he was down in the, was with split entry in those days. And he's like, make sure when you're putting the stair treads or whatever, you know, make sure you leave room for sheetrock. And I was thinking, sheets of rock? I was like, how much, what is a sheets of rock? Because where I grew up, it was drywall. It wasn't sheetrock. So that's how I started in the mid-70s. But within, 6 months, I was foreman. You know, when you really love what you're doing, you just soak it up like a sponge. I was working out of the Seattle area, and sometimes I get on the city bus with a worm drive saw, you know, in my hand, and then go get on another bus walking around town because I had to have your own, I got to have your own tools, you know. So
did you find you had a bit of an aptitude for, you know, cutting and building and some of these, some of these processes take some muscle memory and some skill. And did you kind of find that you were able to pick that up easily, you know, separate from learning the terms and the steps?
Well, it was a funny process because when I think about it, you know, they were hiring people after me, and so they would come on in 2 weeks, and this guy would be a really journeyman, and he would say, how do things happen here? And I would be telling him how it is. You know, and I'd maybe beat him in the door by 2 days, you know, maybe a week. And I'd see a carpenter cutting a board here, and I'd come over here and cut a board. And you just are thinking about it. So I think the aptitude, obviously was there because, you know, before long, basically I'm running the projects and showing the carpenters how I want things done. So, you know, it's interesting, the challenge, because there's a different kind of thinking in the trades than there is book learning, in which case, often school underappreciates or discounts the hand-head connection. You know, I think for many people, that's much more satisfying, a hand-head heart kind of connection that you have in the trade, in which case your math is practical math, your concepts, your designs. And so, you know, so it was, that's kind of how it started for me. And then
there's definitely something satisfying, even more than just building something. But like you said, when you're using your hands and your head, obviously when you have something you've created at the end of the day, and you're learning new things and you're moving your body, it's just compared to other, I guess, careers, maybe like accounting or something, where you're more like looking in the past and there's not as much creativity. It just seems kind of like a completely different world. And for me, more satisfying to be involved in the industry in whatever way.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. You know, we're in a world, an information age, where we're moving bits and bytes, and you don't get to often see the result of your work. So right. It's particularly satisfying when you can say, yeah, I built that. And that's what I want for my employees out on the floor, that at the end of the day, they're not just a cog in a wheel, but they can say, you know, I when they finish a door, I can see when they roll it across to the next station over to get the finish laid on it, that they kind of linger because they made that. You know, it's beautiful. It's ready for the finish. And they, you know, at the end of the day, they can be proud. It wasn't that they just processed 100 doors through a machine, but they... Mm-hmm. They made a piece of artwork. They actually made something. So, and I think that's soulfully important, I think, you know, that the trade offers that a lot of areas don't offer. I mean, an accountant gets a sense of satisfaction when that particular part is done, but you know, it's a different thing, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's true, because they're more like organizing and making things tie out and match, which there's a lot of satisfaction in cleaning up a big mess. So
yeah, they are hitting. Yeah. So and you're tying up something. So, and my job is to make as big a mess as I possibly can for the accountant to go put it together, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so.
So tell me about the next step, because in the mid 70s, you know, building, there was a lot of what would you call that, like production building of subdivisions and high output developments and such. There was also, I'm sure, a lot of beautiful custom homes. But what was kind of the next step? You're running a crew and such, and how what was the next evolution in your career?
Well, I never really got into the big production. It usually was in the Medina, Bellevue, Redmond area. And so it was pretty high-end remodels and stuff such as that. Okay. But it wasn't long. Within a year, I went out on my own. And,
wow.
So I've been a contractor. And from that first year, I've never worked for anyone else. And so that's another kind of thing that's, I have a hard time relating to certain particular things. But I never really got involved in the heavy production. And, you know, I would take a lot of flack from other builder friends, you know, and they're like, man, I could have framed or built that in a weekend or whatever. Why is it taking you, I don't know, a month or six months or whatever? You got to kind of pick your own path and what kind of resonates with yourself. You know, I did plenty of things, what you did just to make it happen, to put food on the table, and you know, you got to make your compromises, but by and large, it kind of fell into doing design build. Design build wasn't really a concept at the time, but the regulations and the whatever was loose enough that you didn't have to be an architect or you didn't have to engineer particularly during that period of time. So I started designing. But when I designed, I would then build, put a price on it, and then it was my responsibility to bring it in and give them the key for that same number. So, and then in the mid 80s, I fell into timber framing. There was a seminar put on by the guru of timber framing at the time, Ted Benson out of New Hampshire. And that was an interesting phase. I had a lot of passion for it. So when I finished a seminar week or two of hands-on work with another group of tradespeople that were enthused in that particular area, then I incorporated timber framing into everything. And so, which was interesting, and that's kind of moved the craft forward. And so whenever I did a project, I would design it, but something in that house was going to be timber framed. And often when you design a house, they take it to go get appraised to determine the amount of money that the customer can borrow to build the house. Well, I've got to make that house happen within a reasonable range of that, between that and whatever cash they bring to the table. So often when the appraiser would come in the end, they would raise the appraisal of, I don't know, $80,000 to $100,000. And of course, my customer was very happy. And maybe I walked away with an extra six pack out of it. But I had the satisfaction of the quality of the house, the look, the integrity that I felt was important. And, you know, I know where each of those houses are, and I know when they sell and come on the market, which isn't that often, they typically, someone in will say, hey, I saw that a house that you built is on the market in some particular place. So that was always, you know, it take a lot of sacrifice because I put a lot of labor into those houses that didn't get recognized, so to speak, you know. But
so is it safe to say that's where you started first thinking of aspects that could be built into a home that would maybe raise the appraisal value disproportionately to the amount of labor, effort, or money that went into it? Obviously, doors would be an example of this type of thing. Is that where this started showing up?
Right. So I would, I wanted to do artful, soulful houses. And so I'm stubborn, you know. So you're like, I want to build what I want to build. And so you're looking for customers that you mix with well, that their vision and your vision, because you kind of got to get into their head while you're designing, and you're looking for a similar vision or a similar output, and someone that you can work with that isn't going to, you know, quote, manipulate or squeeze you too hard. So when I would design a house, often I wouldn't design in the timber frame because code people didn't understand it, and you'd be forced into a lot of compromises. But then I would build it relatively conservatively so that it fit, but in the lines it fit in there that you could do. But I wanted the houses, and I think I was pretty successful in a good number of them, so that wherever you stood in the house, whatever you were looking at was a picture. Picture quality was artwork. And so I started using reclaimed timbers, and I would start maybe doing some of my own texture on the sheetrock. Or I would build the cabinets, or at times I would build the windows. And I had a client that I built an English house that they took inspiration from a Shakespeare kind of house. And then they would bring me all the leaded glass, and then I had to make the sash, work backwards to the sash, and then to the frame, to the rough opening that I had to frame into the house that would fit this leaded glass. So that was always a challenge. And then the segue from that is that when I went to put a door, or I couldn't find a door. It was before the days of Home Depot, but the standard doors just didn't look like they belonged in this particular house. And so I would start making the door package for the house and the trim package. So the kind of builder I was, I would do the foundation, I would do the framing, I would do the roofing. And part of the purpose was I wouldn't want to be chasing subs down. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with subs, you got to wait 2 weeks. And it was like, that doesn't help me put food on the table.
Right.
So I would do one house at a time, and it would take 10 months to a year. But wow. You would do everything. So every day you're there, you know, and you're using a minimum amount of subs that would make sense. But in terms of in the crafts part of it, you touched it.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, at the end of it, it was a house built by, you know, yourself. So then I started building doors. And, you know, at the time, I didn't really think about where that was going to lead. But it did lead in that particular direction. And then I think I built a house for myself. I decided to go to South America and do volunteer community development for a 3-year period in the 90s. Wow. And I built a house to come back to that I wanted. I built it in a farmhouse style, but I didn't want it to look like a new style farmhouse. I wanted it to look like the homestead that people would mistake, that think was the original one in the area, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so then I built a carriage house next to it, and I built it with the style of a salt box, New England, and put a cupola on top. Uh-huh. And then I put garage doors on it, and then I decided they needed to look old. They needed to look stylized, in which case they should just be doors.
Right.
And then I built the doors for the house and everything that I did as part of the house, but then I built doors for the carriage house. And then I decided they really needed an opener. So then I picked up a garage door opener and then rewired it, flipped everything around until I could make it do what I wanted it to do. And that was,
wow,
95.
Wow.
And then I left for 3 years and came back. And I think the year was 2000 when I built a house, and the customer said, yeah, we'd like to do carriage doors. Well, they were thinking carriage doors that in the garage door industry look like they do this, but roll up.
Yes.
But they were a customer that lived in another town. So I built a 3-car guest house garage, and then I put openers on them. And then when they came one weekend and they said, I went to show them, and I pushed 3 remote buttons, and all 3 of these doors started opening up. They just about fell over because they never see anything like that, you know. And that's kind of where everything went, because at the time that was really early with the internet, and I made a website, one of those homemade websites, and one of the menu option says, does your garage doors do this? And then it went to a page and I showed a picture of the garage doors in different positions. There was no video or anything. Uh-huh. And for 3 years, I would get emails. How much? What style? Can you do this or that? And I would just delete them. Because it was like, well, I don't have time for this. You know, if I built you a house, sure, I'll make the doors. But I'm not going to just, you know. So for 3 years, this story is known around the company because I've told it a few times. And I'm probably bored out of there to hear it, you know. But 3 years later in early 03, I came home, I think I'd poured a foundation, and you're just exhausted. And you come in the door, and I had like 10 emails. And I'm in a bad mood, and I just want to delete them, but there was 10. And so I went to the internet and said, carriage doors. And the first site that came up was, that's what I'm talking about. So I clicked on it, and it was my silly little internet page.
Wow.
So at that point, it was like, okay, I'm a contractor. I can figure this out. But it was like, here, I'm smelling an opportunity here.
Yeah.
Right? So I was used to figuring a job out. Okay, I got this much materials. I got this much labor. It's going to cost me this and this much time. And I started building them nights and weekends. And then I'd have to tell the customer, hey, I won't be on the job site Wednesday because I have to finish da-da-da. So that just kind of grew from there till I got to a point where I just couldn't ignore it anymore. So, and then it just grew. I was building basically in my two-car garage until, you know, you got 6-8 inches of sawdust, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I was looking for it, because I wasn't. I loved what I was doing. In fact, during that period of time, I built the coolest house, kind of my Mona Lisa, coolest house I'd ever designed and built, a very modern, frontier, rustic, modern house that was. But it was like, okay, am I going to go down this road or am I going to go down this road? And there you go.
And there you go. And I'm sure at some moment, like maybe that moment when you came home after pouring concrete and had 10 emails, while I'm sure building is satisfying, there's particular parts that you're like, could go without. For example, on that day, maybe you didn't want to see concrete anymore, in which case carriage doors sounded maybe a little more appealing in terms of, you know, where to put your energy.
Well, I kind of think, and I think in every man's life, or let's say craft person's life, you kind of have to make some decisions. And I think at that time, when I look back at that, I was like, I finally had to get out of my own way, if that makes sense. I had to, at that point, I wanted to touch everything. And then at some point, you had to kind of go, you know, I have to scale a little bit. I have to specialize, or I can't control everything. Maybe it's a control aspect. Yeah. But you have to kind of find a balance in the trades. It's kind of like when you pull a tape measure. Are you measuring to the between the 16ths? Right. Are you measuring to the 16th or the 8th? Or what are you going to call it? This is 15 and 7/8 plus, or how you call that out, knowing where that balance is. And then I think, in a sense, you kind of have to find that within yourself.
Yeah.
Where am I going to get too down? In your life, you don't really want to live at the 32nd. You want to kind of lighten up so that you've got some room to move. And in a sense, I felt like when I look back at that, I kind of got out of my own way as a tradesperson so that I felt like I could still be authentic to the craft and to what I kind of wanted to create and bring forward.
I think that's really hard for tradespeople, and especially tradespeople who like having the tools on and doing the work, because they, in addition to being good at it and caring the most, they like it. So anyways, I could imagine, even after that moment where you're, let's say, building more carriage doors, that was an ongoing experience of having to let other people build. You know, you have quite a team now, and so I'm guessing that began a process of almost like getting the hang of letting other folks take care of things, right?
Exactly. So part of it is age. You know, I think at that time I was like 52. So you're kind of like, this isn't as easy to carry the bags. You know, in the last house I built, it was like, you know what, this is starting to be a little more like work. You know, I wasn't running to my van and running back, you know, the energy. You're like, right. You know, the timing was pretty good. I encourage tradespeople to enjoy the years of energy and creativity and the abilities that we have when we're younger, you know. And so it kind of came at a particularly good time, but getting out of our way and letting people kind of work with you and, in a sense, share the skills and share your knowledge with your team.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. That's pretty neat. When you're telling the story, I imagined it happened sooner, but did you say you were 52 when that happened and you
exactly.
kind of made that? Wow. So you had a full career of building. It wasn't just a handful of houses or years. You have been at it a while.
I try not to add up the decades, but probably three and a half decades of, you know, just pure one man building. You know, I would have a helper, but pretty much I like to touch it. It's you're solving it, and it's just satisfying touching your materials and textures and the different things that you can bring to the project.
It can be, you know, when you're young, it can be scary to take risks and try brand new things. I'm sure when you're 52, it's, you know, that much more challenging. And as we get older, I think people become a little, I don't know, conservative in terms of, you know, playing it safe and taking risk and stuff. So did it feel like it was a risky kind of career move to not take another house build, or did it just feel kind of like a natural, like maybe less risky? What did that feel like?
You know, I'm kind of a risk taker anyway. So, you know, you're taking measured risk and, you know, you sit down in the chair and you say, you know, let's take a run at this and see what I can make it, you know. I think when I first came back from South America, I thought, okay, I've done building for 3 decades. Maybe I should do something new. So I did take a year or so and went and did radiant heat, hot water heat, because it's really technical. Yeah. You got to know gallons per minute to BTU, and that is really satisfying engineering, thinking it through. But after about a year, year and a half, it was like, I like building. I just like design and building. So all the houses I've done since the 80s, I've incorporated radiant heating. So it was just one more arrow in the quiver, so to speak.
Right.
But, you know, you kind of go down a path. I was building doors down in the Amazon, and, you know, I look back on it and it's like, you can connect the dots in the past, you know, but often when you're in the middle of it, you've got to call it out when you kind of can't see, but everything's risky. And if a person has a job, they think, okay, I'm not in that much risk, but you can get fired. And then you thought you had security, and then suddenly you don't. So when you wake up every day and say, I got to go make it happen or it isn't going to happen, that's just reality. So, and it's the reality, really, for all of us. So I don't think I thought of it as any riskier than anything else. I did,
that makes sense.
You know, it doubled like every year for years. So it's been a fun ride.
Amazing what that little homemade website picture sequence you put up did to prep and create that opportunity. I mean, obviously you had no idea when you put it up, but talk about that sort of open the door, I guess, of, you know, positioned you really as the leader before you even started offering the service.
Well, it's amazing because at the time nobody was thinking about garage doors being doors.
Right.
You know, we think of this, but these aren't doors, they're panels.
Yes.
So, you know, it was kind of a renaissance in that area. And I think during that time, I was invited to go to this garage door operator convention. And I was like, who ever heard of such a thing? You know, so I went out of curiosity, and people would say, what do you do? Well, I build these swing out garage doors, and they'd look at you. They're from overhead door, all of that kind of thing. And they'd look at you, and I remember one of them said, why? Just kind of, well, because, you know. So now the garage door industry recognizes swing out doors now. I mean, those days, I mean, we've made a mark and carved out a niche in a, you know, rather $2 or $3 billion industry in a swing outdoor from nothing. And so that's kind of fun to do.
Yeah, no kidding. And I could imagine that was like a funny moment. You're like, if I have to explain to you why we're doing this, I don't know how you could understand it anyways. Just don't worry about it. It's kind of like a, how do you even answer that?
Well, exactly. Funny. In fact, that brings up kind of the difference between a tradesperson and just a run-of-the-mill business in the trade person. Because... Yeah. Do you love your craft, or is it a means, or is it a part of everything?
Yeah.
So if you're taking something on just to have a lunch bucket and take the lunch bucket home, that's one thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. That is the most common experience. But if there's a love of the craft, of the touch, of what you're trying to actually accomplish, and in a sense, that's what I market to. That's from the very beginning. I'm looking for that customer that wants to do that other artful thing or functional thing or something that's got a more intrinsic value. We have a, when I did this last house, it was shaped like an H, capital H, and I had three timber frame towers on it. And a really good builder friend of mine brought a girlfriend, his girlfriend, to see this house, and I was almost done with it. And the carriage doors were moving somewhat at that time, and I was working nights and weekends and everything. And then I was going to, she was a realtor, so okay. So I was bought the property next door, and I was going to build this another house, a speculative house in this style that I had created. And this realtor said, you can't do that. And I'm like, what do you mean I can't do that? Well, there's a formula for a spec house. You got to have this, 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 and this house isn't it. You just went over the top, and you can't do this style, and this is, don't even think about it. You have to build for sheep. And you can imagine the hair on the back of my neck. All I just immediately did not like my friend's girlfriend, right? Yeah. And it was like, I immediately just responded and said, I don't build for sheep. I build for wolves. Uh-huh. And in a sense, that's what we're looking for. Someone that's, you know, that's kind of, who is enjoying the craft, whether it's the trades guy or the young man looking to create a creative direction for his life, and also the customer that is looking for something that has a deeper intrinsic value in the home or the project, whether it's a remodel or a door or whatever. And so we ended up calling that particular house the Lone Wolf House, you know, Lone Wolf Project, because it kind of was, okay, we're picking our own path, and we're trying to be deliberate and authentic in terms of our materials, in terms of the experience of our employees in the craft, and our approach to our customers.
Yeah. You know. In terms of taking risk, maybe a little, let's talk about doors themselves, because I'm sure by now you've built doors out of every available material with every custom feature you could think of. But at the same time, I'm sure that people call from time to time with an idea or a slab of wood that is, you know, important to them. How often are you taking on projects or having to scratch your head about doors, even at this point, to build something? You know, everything you build is unique, but how often does something come through that's really, really unique or uncommon? Or have you covered it all by now, and at this point, it's hard to surprise you?
Sales team ends up in my office 3 or 4 times a week. I got somebody that wants the X, you know, and so, you know, you try to kind of go, how could we do that? How can we get to yes, if at all possible? And I don't think we turn down much unless they want it out of plastic or, you know, yeah. They want, can you use that no maintenance plastic PVC AZEK or whatever they call it. And it's like, I think we got the wrong phone number here, you know.
Yeah, wrong person.
Yeah, but I think we have a little bit more freedom because we use pure wood.
Yeah.
We use the the timber. We don't slice off veneers,
right?
You know, so you know, there's like two dozen woods that we pretty commonly work with, and so you kind of go, okay, you got price levels, and what kind of wood are you, you know, you talking about? And so you kind of design whether the panels are metal or, you know, the shape of the glass or, you know, and the styles tend to change and the trends kind of change. And so, you know, we kind of have to be in front of stuff. You know, in the Great Recession, I had a little bit of a dip, maybe 15%. And that's kind of when we kind of designed some hardware. I thought, I mean, doors slide. So let's get some hardware and see what we can do here that sells more doors. And that's, so we went and found barn door hardware out on the barn and decided to civilize it, bring it inside and promote that so that we could sell more doors. Well, that turned into barn door hardware.
Right.
And that just exploded. And I think I started doing that in 2009 because the recession, that big dip hit late 2008. And then that just exploded, as we all know. It's everywhere now. But I knew then, and it certainly was true, that you have a period of, say, 5 years before competition discovers.
Right.
And if you've got a product, and the barn door flat truck in particular, is easy to replicate, manufacture, then you're more vulnerable. It's similar to developments where the houses are just flipped down the street. Right. And so overseas market pretty much put a kibosh to that particular product line, or at least in the low quality area. And then when we would make plank sliding doors, that also now is being taken. You see it at Home Depot and Lowe's, and it's in Masonite, and it comes from overseas. So you kind of have to stay on top of that. Or at least I've had to. And so it's kind of exciting because I had avoided going into entry doors because we started with these swing out garage doors, and then entry doors are everywhere. Everyone has one. So do I really want to wade into that? I'd done them, obviously built them for the houses I built, but that's a long time ago. But it was like, okay, if we're going to go into it, we got to go into it with our voice, our look, our method, and basically build what no one else really can build, because they're buying a $1 million machine and they feed it some sticks and out come, I don't know, five designs.
Yeah.
So we've kind of done that, and right now we're kind of buried. I mean, they really hit the market really pretty well for us. But part of it is around this philosophy that I think, again, is true to the trade, is I want the machine to work for us, not us for the machine.
Yeah.
So whenever we go to buy a machine, you're like, you have to ask that question. So I don't want my guys on the floor to, I'm just doing this all day. You know, I want them to be head in the game. That's important. mistake or no mistake, that their need to be present, and therefore at the end of the day, they're a craftsman.
Yeah. About trends, you mentioned trends kind of coming and going in construction, and that definitely happens, but there's also trends that come, like maybe barn doors would be an example where it just kind of creates a whole new option for people. And is it ever going to go away? No, because there's always going to be a setting where it makes a lot of sense, you know, where it's the most, you know, or like pocket doors, you know. I'm sure at one point it was like a new thing that showed up, but that's different than a trend, because these types of options can be used now in every builder's toolkit, and in some ways even entry doors, where certain builders, and we obviously just finished this home, and the builder here, he has always built homes with his door manufacturer, which is kind of a more standard door and window shop where they just kind of process, and that's just the way he's kind of always done it. And if they can't get it, he doesn't necessarily think right off like, I'm missing out on this whole, you know, type of product. But anyways, then kind of seeing, you know, this door and something new, it just opens, oh, this whole new like arena of options. And even for something as typical as an entry door, which has been around for a long time.
In the trade, so this is something that's easy to fall into, and it's, you know, something you kind of, in the craft, you kind of want to find your own voice counter that, or at least in my view, is how can you do something that's different rather than just what's easiest, you know, right? Because the easiest is to call the door trim shop and they come down and measure, well, you got 4,000 feet of base and you got a left-hand door and a right-hand door and we can do the six panel. Where you see six panel doors are everywhere. I mean, would I build a six panel door? Sure, I'd build a six panel door. But why? Back to the guy, why don't you build a swing out garage door? Well, why would I build a six panel door purposefully? Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm going to throw beige out onto beige. There's enough beige. So I think it takes a deliberateness, both on the part of the customer and certainly the tradesperson, as he's looking for a career, or he's already a builder and he's in the trade and he's trying to create a niche. It takes a deliberateness to say, let me at least offer something different, a different texture besides orange peel on the wall. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what's a different avenue? And I think it's exciting what's out there. I wish I had the energy and 48 hours in a day to do more, you know. I'm satisfied, and you know, it's fun and it keeps you on the edge to know, or not to know, but to try and predict a trend. You know, what sold early in the year isn't particularly selling right now, but we came out with some timbered doors, full thickness doors, and some new looks. We have a new line of round top doors that will probably be hitting our website in a week or two. That I don't know if they're going to catch fire. You just lay them out there and you kind of follow it. But, you know, it's the journey's. Certainly part of it. I look back on the 70s and there were some really ugly houses that were on trend. And there are today, each decade, you typically could drive down a street, probably, your dad could, you could, and go, that's spring 84.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, just nail it.
You 98.
Yeah.
The fall edition, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were there. We probably nailed some fascia boards on something, you know.
Yeah.
Or try to create something more timeless, but you would look back on it and go, I can still see hints of the 90s or whatever in it. So,
here's a question for you. Maybe we'll kind of wrap up on this. The builder who built our house and installed this door, he's a master carpenter. It was no big deal. He didn't even bat an eye at the door. He knew exactly what to do. But I was kind of nervous because it was certainly, I hadn't seen a door quite like this before. And it made me think about other, not just the homeowners, but other carpenters and tradespeople who might be uncomfortable installing something they haven't installed quite like this before. And an entry door maybe is not a good example, but a carriage door is probably a good example. What do you, how do you help contractors, or what do you say to you know, carpenters who are installing these things in terms of not just getting help with it, but also just taking the risk of trying something kind of new and, you know, satisfying their customer? Do you have any, if there's someone listening who's like, oh man, I'd love to build one of those, but I don't know if I could install a, not build one, sorry, I'd love to install one of those, but I'd hate to screw it up. What can you say to those guys?
I love talking to a builder that, you know, is at calling and asking, hey, how do I approach this or that? We've done a few videos, a couple I think of in particular, where one of my trades guys gone through it, and I really like it because a tradesperson can look at that and go, he can fill in around it because he knows the approach to work, and just a couple of hints can help a lot. But I always enjoy it myself when I can get a builder on the phone, and it doesn't always often come to my phone. You know, they're dealing it with staff, but I love it when I can, because it's a different language. You're talking builder to builder. But when I would say about a carriage door, it's like setting up a normal set of double doors. It just happens to be bigger. You know, you're typically, where you put your hinges is important. I mean, where you put your shims, you know, you go through the typical process of jamming in the top of the jam and getting secure on your hinges. What we do kind of, I call it Euro. Anytime I find a favorite thing that I want to do that I consider important in the trade, I call it Euro hinges or Euro something, because Euro always sounds European and people go, wow, if it's European, then that would be really cool. Yeah. And so we kind of have a Euro placement of hinges. It's even on our website. You want Euro placement or American placement?
Yeah.
And we always steer them towards Euro. What's that basically means, you put your hinges high, and I'm sure you saw that on that.
Yeah,
door.
That's how ours is. Yeah.
And as soon as you see that as a builder, you're like, duh. Of course I put the hinges up high, because the top hinges are doing all the work, holding the gravity and grabbing that door and holding it up. And so if you look at the American style, the top hinge is pulling on the door. The bottom hinge is pushing on the door.
Right.
And the middle hinge does nothing.
Yeah.
It's the same concept. If you have a floor joist and you're going to run plumbing through it, you'd put the hole in the middle of the floor joist because it's the neutral zone.
Right.
And it's the same on a door. You don't put a hinge in the center of the door because it's the neutral zone.
Yeah, it's like the pivot of a seesaw. There's not the compression or tension. It's just
in the middle. Exactly. Yeah. So we load our hinges up high. The heavier the door, the more hinges we put up there. And, you know, so those are kind of little trade things that we do. And we just love talking to carpenters. And we just feel privileged. We kind of blew open two niches in architectural building trade, that being the swing out door and that being barn doors, the sense of, well, I always thought if the door is kind of ugly, put it in a pocket.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to see it. But if you got space and the door is cool, which why would you build a door that isn't cool?
Right.
Then if it's art, then slide it on the outside of the, you know, and enjoy it. And that, you know, wasn't really thought of before. Yeah. And now it's an option that people in, you know, in your house, you can say, wow, that's, yeah, let's have that there. It functions for what you want it to function for. So it's great to kind of been a part of both of those kind of Renaissance movements, you know. And it's fun to talk to builders and kind of help them walk through, you know, the installs on the barn door can be kind of tricky to install as well.
Yeah, I'm sure it has its little quirks that you got to know. After you do one, you kind of like understand. But going into that first one, you want to probably get some, you know,
right
codes, kinda, cheat codes.
Yeah, you're solving a problem in a new way. So
yeah,
it creates a little challenges and it's out of the norm. So,
okay, here's my last question. I think I know the answer, but you know, a builder's subcontractors are as important to them as the tools themselves, because they come in and, like, you know, move the job forward in a way that the builder probably can't. And you guys are up in Washington, but when our door arrived, I mean, it looked like it could have traveled around the world twice before it landed here. And I'm wondering, are your doors shipping all around the country? Is that kind of just no big deal for you guys? You have customers in all the states, or are you mostly kind of working in the Northwest where your shop is, or who are your contractor customers that you're providing doors to, or where are they?
Good question. Gosh, I think Washington is like number 6 or 7 in terms of the ranking of states that we sell into.
Wow. So
we sell a tremendous amount to the East Coast. So we're selling everywhere. I know I've been on some installs on the East Coast and people are like, what are you doing out here? Because you're from the West Coast. And my answer is, this is our market. You know, the whole in Eastern Seaboard, we have doors everywhere. And California is big. Washington is growing, as is Oregon. Washington in particular is moving up from number 8 to maybe number 6. But California, Texas, New York, Massachusetts, Georgia. And yes, we put them in a crate like what you saw. And, you know, they could be across the country in 4 or 5 days, probably beat the postal service, you know. So.
Yeah, oh, that is so cool. And gosh, I'm thinking about the Eastern Seaboard particular, because the style and just the aesthetic of a lot of your products, in my mind, it really lines up with that, the feeling over there. So for those contractors, I mean, why would they go anywhere else when they got a trusted, you know, sub, so to speak, or material provider right there with you guys? That's cool. All right, Don. Well, hey, thank you so much for sharing this. I really feel like tradesmen, hearing about other tradesmen whose careers have evolved and unfolded, can turn some light bulbs on for, you know, for those fellas, which I, you know, those are our people. But even just hearing about the doors themselves and the way that this industry works is really, really fascinating. It's like this old, hard to call it door technology, although of course it is. But at the same time, you just can't help cheer on a company making cutting edge doors out of old material, oak, you know, wood, like the and glass, and yet they still look and feel, and I guess they probably behave cutting edge as if it was, you know, a whole different technology. So it just is a really neat, I don't know, symbol of the trades and how they continue to rely on tradition, but also, you know, the processes, the tools, the shipping, all these things are new and pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think so as well. It's exciting, the technology and the ideas and where building is going and the solutions for how we put our shelters together.
Right. Yeah. Well, for the listeners, if you haven't seen already, you got to watch this video of this door coming together, because separate from a beautiful door, it's craftsmanship at its finest. It's a man building a door out of wood. It's absolutely beautiful. And then you'll see it at the end of that video installed and hung up. And I didn't talk about it here with you, Don, but the conversation around an entry, making a statement, and just the first thing you touch when you come into a house is a whole separate topic around doors. And we may cover that in the video, but I kept you long enough. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. And I hope you guys just keep spreading your doors all around four corners of the globe.
All right. Yeah. And I've enjoyed it. And nice to talk to you today.